Awesome. Universal greetings of peace, love, and justice. Assalamu alaikum. First, I would like to thank, on behalf of the Yemen Youth of Change, for the invitation to come here and to speak to you guys today. The country of Yemen is sometimes overlooked in political affairs and in the media, and for you guys to invite us here to listen to somebody who's active and involved in it, we really do appreciate that. Also, this is my first time coming to Portland, and I'm a big fan of Portland. The group I work with, the second group, the Coalition for Safe SF, it's primarily funded on the basis of the Portland Resolution that was established here in regards to the Joint Terrorism Task Force involvement with the local law enforcement. And we're taking actually your model and trying to implement it in San Francisco. And this Thursday, we have a vote in City Hall in San Francisco to pass an ordinance that would basically give us the similar ordinance of yours in San Francisco and have civilian oversight of our police department instead of federal oversights. Because oftentimes the FBI, they deputize local law enforcement agents or local law enforcement, and they take away a lot of our civil liberties. So the country of Yemen, it's not known to a lot of people, the history of Yemen, why it's important, and what is this country that's kind of dangling off the bottom of the Arabian Peninsula? What is it all about? It's not the plural of yams. It has a rich history that goes over thousands of years. And it's always been a part of something. In biblical times, Yemen, had the trade of frankincense and myrrh, and that's what established Yemen's economy. And through that economic process, there was a civilization that flourished in Yemen. And you might have heard stories of the Queen of Sheba or similar things of that nature. So Yemen had a very rich and flourishing population and culture early on. And we see remnants of that in the old cities of Madib in Yemen, or Zafar in central Yemen, or Hadramaut in southern Yemen. Massive structures and great civilization history that was built at that time. Also, for Arabs in the Middle East, Yemen plays a very vital role, and in a sense that the majority of scholars on Arabs and the Arab people have collectively agreed that the origins of Arabs originate from Yemen. The Yemeni tribes had a diaspora, and they spread out to different parts of the Arabian Peninsula. You had the Lachemiyun tribes who went to Iraq and parts of Iran. You had the Ghassassanid tribes who went to Syria and Lebanon. Many Maronite Christians go back to the Ghassassanid tribes. Even the Roman Emperor Philip the Arab was from this tribe. And even in the Gulf countries, a lot of these tribes come to Yemen. And in the spread of Islam in the 7th century, many of the ground forces and troops came out of Yemen, the northern tribalmen of Yemen. And they went, and you see tribes like the Banu Hilal tribe that settled in Tunisia, and Abu Zayd al-Hilali, who was a famous Arabic hero in Arabic folklore. You have tribes of Bint al-Ahmar who went to Spain and established in Spain, and many more. So there's always been a history of Yemen, Yemeni tribes throughout the Middle East. And going forward, Yemen's role in the region, Egypt primarily always played the central role of the Islamic Empire, the Arab, because of its strategic location in the center of the Arabian, of the Middle East. And my purpose today is to give insight and to kind of isolate the country of Yemen and try to understand what its role is in the Arab Spring. Every country in the Arab Spring has its own role, its own flavor, and to understand the Arab Spring and the revolution, you have to look at Yemen's revolution, why it occurred, how it happened, and what significance it has, because many of the answers that haven't been answered come through this revolution in Yemen. So, like I said, Yemen always had something to offer the world. After their spice and frankincense trade, Yemen was known for their rape for coffee. Although coffee originated in Ethiopia, East in Africa, it wasn't made into a brew, into a tea to drink, until it was brought to Yemen. And up until the early 1800s, all coffee in the world came from Yemen. Mocha is actually a city port in southern Yemen. It's called Al-Makha in Arabic. A lot of people don't know that. And it was because of Western colonization that a lot of coffee was spread out throughout the world. Dutch were able to take it to Indonesia, and then from there they took it all around the world. But originally coffee came from Yemen, and it had a flourishing coffee trade. The Ottomans, who had annexed Yemen, would boil the coffee beans so they won't be able to grow again. And even when the Ottoman Turks fought in the Battle of Vinay in Austria, one of the prized possessions that the Western troops were able to get from the Muslims was this blue coffee. And the history of coffee, it's an amazing history, how it changed the world and how through coffee shops, revolutions were formed, people came together and talked about politics. So it's that's a different topic. Then the spread of Islam came. So the Prophet's cousin, or actually his nephew, Ali, who married one of his daughters, he was sent to Yemen. He was sent to Yemen to sort of invite the Muslims, or the Arabs there at the time, to Islam. The first person who was sent to Yemen was another companion of Prophet Muhammad. His name was Mu'adh bin Jabal, and he wasn't able to become successful. And when Ali, son of Abu Talib, went to there, the Prophet Muhammad told him, you know, tell him these words. And there were, you know, that the people of Yemen are the people of wisdom, the people have the gentlest hearts, you know. And for Yemeni tribesmen, they like when people praise them. And the Hamdan tribes of northern Yemen, where my family's from, adopted Islam, and Islam became the dominant religion in that country. And so in the beginning of the Muslim expansion, Yemeni people were, for the most part, the ground soldiers that went throughout the Umayyad Empire and the first spread of Islam. And they spread around from Egypt to North Africa to Spain. And after that, there was a succession of Zaydi imams. They followed a particular part of Shi'ism, which is called Zaydism. And they're the closest to Sunnism. They believe that the fifth imam is Imam Zayd, who was the half-brother of Muhammad al-Baqir. And they have different ideological differences between the Shi'as of Iran, the Twelvers, and them, in regards to the infallibility of the imams, in regards to the station of some of the companions, the wife Aisha of Muhammad, peace be upon him, and other things. So they were closer to Sunni Islam, so and because of that, they were able to stay in Yemen for the longest period of time. And this succession of imam ruled from the 9th century all the way to the 1960s, early 60s, the Zaydi imams. So they had over 1,000 years of dynasty that lasted in Yemen. And it's important to know about this dynasty because it has a lot to do with the current political situation in Yemen. So at the same time, these many Western forces wanted to control Yemen because of its strategic location, especially after the opening of the Suez Canal. Bab al-Mandab, the area between Yemen and East Africa, is a very important route for boats and for ships to go through, even in our modern times. And so Yemen always played a strategic location and role in the world, in world trade. So many countries tried to colonize Yemen. No country was ever able to occupy or colonize northern Yemen. The south, Aden, and some of the sultanates in the south became a protectorate to the British Empire, and they were able to rule Yemen for over 120 years, in which they had sultans who controlled the area regions, but they ruled in the financial interests of Britain. And in the 1960s, there was a revolution in the south to fight this occupation, and they were able to become successful. And then in 1970, in the early 70s, the southern Yemen became adopted the Marxist left ideology of socialism at the time. And this is very important because Yemen was the only country to join the Warsaw Pact in the Arabian Peninsula, in the Middle East. It was the only country to be socialist and Marxist in the Middle East. And it was a hub for many of the of different radical ideas in the Middle East at the time. Many people supported that government. Many Western governments did not support it. And Yemen was at the time trying to become unified. Northern Yemen, after the revolution against the Imam in the 1960s, was the first country and is still the only country to be a republic in the Arabian Peninsula. So the majority of the monarchs in the Arabian Peninsula and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries were against Yemen in that first revolution. to become a republic. Jamal Abdel Nasser played a vital role. Egypt sent over 80,000 troops to Yemen because it saw the strategic importance of Yemen to overthrow the type of sheikh or monarch ruling that was prevalent in Yemen. And so they supported the revolution. And Saudi Arabia and the other countries supported the royalists for the imam. At the end, the republic won, and in similar fashion to the rest of the countries in the Middle East, there were generals that came out in prominence and ruled Yemen, but majority of them were not able to sustain power. And so all of them were assassinated, except for one, who was the first and the only civilian president. His name was Al-Iryani, and he was exiled to Syria. Every other president who took over power in Yemen, or general, was assassinated. There was one in particular ruled in the 80s named Ibrahim al-Hamdi, and he was trying to bridge between socialism and democracy. And he was the first to start the first steps of the unification process of Yemen, and was the first to visit southern Yemen and to visit the government there and to start laying the foundations for the unification of Yemen. He was, for the most part, he took the socialist route, and many countries in the West, America particularly, did not like him, and Saudi Arabia did not like him either. So he was assassinated, and his assassination was kind of vague. No one knows exactly who did it. For the most part, it was northern tribal men who said that he was a non-believer, a non-Muslim, because they accused him of fornication and different things, and he was assassinated. And the person who took power was Al-Ghashmi, and he was a very ruthless general. And the people in the south loved him so much that they actually, they loved the Ibrahim al-Hamdi. They sent a package or delivery to the new president, and it was a luggage full of explosives. So he opened it, and he died automatically. And the person who came, no one really wanted to rule Yemen. Northern Yemen, for the longest time, you know, because they're afraid. Anybody who took power was assassinated and killed. There were so many different factors. Yemen still has a lot of very strong tribes. So you have to learn how to, you know, deal with these tribes. And you have, you know, the south, and you have different factions. So no one really wanted to take power. They're afraid. Then came a young general by the name of Ali Abdullah Saleh. And he went to a very powerful tribesman who passed away 2 years ago, named Abdullah ibn Hussein al-Ahmad, from the Ahmad tribe. So they were both from the same tribal confederation called Hashid. And the imam before used the tribes to fight each other. He was a master at divide and conquer and using this method to control Yemen. And he also had a system where he ransomed the sons of the tribal leaders. He kept them in his palace. And he had hundreds of tribal leaders' sons in his palace at a time to make sure he controlled the tribes. So he goes to Abdullah ibn Hussein al-Ahmad, and he tells him, you know, let me take power for, you know, and Abdullah ibn Hussein al-Ahmad says in his memoirs years later that he thought that he would last for about a week. But he took power, and he was able to, and still is to, he calls it dancing. He said that ruling Yemen was like dancing on the heads of snakes. And there was a book written recently about that. And he took power. And he really did not like the South. He had a animosity because he was friends with the previous president who was assassinated. So he had, just the first thing he did was almost start a revenge against the Southern people and attacking them. Eventually, there was the South and the North had open talks for unification. They had a conference in Kuwait. And that conference, you know, the representative for the South, Ali Sam al-Bidh and Ali Abdullah Saleh met and signed the first documents in the chapters for unification. So they were unified in 1990, May 22, 1990. But Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president of the North, he really did not really care too much for the Southern people because population-wise, the North always had more people. It had, even now, it's about 20 million people in the North, maybe 25, and the South had about 4 million people. So you can see the different in populations. Also, the South, because of the Marxist and socialist governments that ruled, they were able to just get rid of tribalism and that system. So the Northern people were always more tribal. They were easier for them to use them as soldiers, as, you know, mercenaries. And the South were more, I guess you could say, peaceful and less militarized. The south is about twice the land size of the north, and the majority of Yemen's resources, natural gas and oil, is located in the south. So in 1994, the southern president, Alassane Albiid, declared that he wanted to secede from this union that did not at all represent the southern people, did not give them equal rights, did not give them equal protection. It used their lands, it took their resources, and there are so many different types of oppression that happened to the southern people, even till now, that they decided to secede and to separate. For them, that was the best goal. And this was in 1994. But, of course, the Yemeni president in the north was always backed by America and the Western allies because he was a capitalist ruler in form of government, and they did not like the socialist South, Marxist South. So he was able to win militarily and take over the South and occupy the South. And I use the word occupation because that's what happened. There was no unification in 1994. And what happened was the people there in the South lost their lands, and these tribes in the North and the government's presidents' families came and took their lands and resources, opened up hotels, made the South a, you know, kind of like Vegas in Yemen. And even now, you know, there's liquor and alcohol in the South, nightclubs, more of a nightlife. A lot of the Saudi princes like to come to the South to Aden to party. And I've seen this firsthand when I visited Yemen. So he won that battle, in that war. And after that, he started a type of government that was full of nepotism, that was full of oppression. Maybe the type of oppression in Yemen was different than Egypt and Tunisia because of the role of tribes in Yemen that were able to balance power. Yemen has over 70 million pieces of weapons. And, you know, people in Yemen, because of their tribal affiliations, often went to their tribemen and tribe clans to resort to, you know, disputes between the government. And there was a government there, but for the most part, people went back to their tribes. So after that unification, quote-unquote, he ruled and created a regime full of corruption, bribery, oppression, and it became a culture, a way of life in Yemen. Even though Yemen has many resources, it has many like fields of grass and natural like resources and agriculture, and it should be, you know, let me show you some pictures of Yemen to understand even because of the system he had, Yemenis weren't able to benefit from the minerals they had, natural resources, export of fish, their agriculture, all these things Yemen had, and it should be a flourishing country, but it ranks the lowest in the world because of the level of corruption in Yemen. So let me show you some pictures to illustrate some of these videos. Let's see here. So when people think about Yemen, they automatically assume they see desert dunes and camels. You know, I lived in Yemen for a year and a half the first time I went to Yemen when I was 13 years old. And for a year and a half, I did not see the desert. This is what I saw. And just fields and fields of green, lush lands. Let's see here. If you can get this. So this is central Yemen. Let me open this up here. If I can open it here. Okay. More here. So, you think that this was in South America. Waterfalls and rivers and fields and see here. And even in Islam and Arabic, they say that Yemen is the land of the Jannatain, the land of two gardens, because of how much agriculture and greenery it had. See here, just this is in front of my house. I don't know if it's cleared up over there, but see here. Just green. And this is in the south, in Mahra. And let's see if I can find maybe one more picture to show you guys. Let's see here. Oh, wait a minute.
Greener in the south?
It's actually in the southwest of east of Yemen. It's desert. The empty quarter is in that location. But from northern Yemen down to Aden to the south, you'll have these pockets of just green areas and vast valleys and vegetation, and it was just a beautiful location. And people just assumed that, you know, Arabia, desert, camel. So I was really like happy to be exposed to that. And even me living here, I remember when I left my family to Yemen in 2003 for the first time, I think I was 13, 12, but my younger brother was about 7. He wanted to pack water because he thought that there was no water in Yemen. It was desert. So even us being here, we had this idea of how Yemen was. But because of the regime in Yemen, because of the networks of nepotism, you never had an agriculture minister who really went to agricultural school or had studied in that. You had a shuffle of the government's, the president's family members and his friends from Minister of Defense to Minister of Agriculture. No experience. And then Minister of Agriculture to Minister of Tourism, or Minister of Tourism to Minister of Education. And this happened for 33 years, you know. And it led many of Yemenis to go and seek work and seek sustenance outside of Yemen. So they went all over the world. My family, my grandfather walked when he was 13 years old from Yemen to Saudi Arabia, then to the Gulf. And then he went to England and then came to America in the late 60s. Some of the things that differentiated this president from other Arab presidents was, in the Gulf War, he's one of the few that supported Saddam Hussein and even sent aid and sent, you know, some supplies he had. And what happened was, because of this, the Gulf countries, they were very angry by this, and they expelled over 1 million Yemenis from Saudi Arabia and 1 million from the Gulf countries. And this really devastated Yemen's economy. And these people I know, family members who came back, they no longer had any money or any wealth, so they had to go and immigrate to America and other countries, and it really made Yemen a lot more poor than it already was. And after that, the Yemeni, you know, rial, the currency, dropped dramatically. And right now, the Yemeni rial, $1 is equivalent to 250 rials. And it's the poorest country, Arab country, in the Middle East. And in terms of, if you look at the index of world countries, it's one of the highest corrupted. It also has the second highest birth rate in the world, and so that's not helping the economy. So he was able to last and stay in power for 33 years. And Yemenis living abroad would go back to the country to give money and send money. That was one of the main sources of income for Yemen. And an example of how he used up the resources, in Shebwa, this is an area in southern Yemen, it has a huge natural gas plant over there. And they sell the natural gas to Korea at a cheaper rate than Yemeni citizens buy it themselves. And the ministers in charge of this, they get kickbacks from the governments. They also allow other countries to come and, you know, fish in Yemeni lands. They allow various types of economic exploitation of the country itself. And this lasted for the longest time. And when I would visit Yemen, I would see this corruption, you know. Maybe the jails weren't full of political prisoners like they were in Tunisia or Egypt, but there were some there. But people were poor. And I thought that, you know, people in Yemen were just weak people who couldn't speak out for their rights. It was just the culture that they lived in. This is how it is. And me coming here from America, I saw people protesting, you know, when fees went up in schools, when, you know, and there was some little change in America, but people, you know, spoke out for their rights. Whereas in Yemen, people, you know, the average person did not have that ability, did not think that there was any point of doing that. So there weren't really that many protests. You don't see the establishment of labor unions. There's some for teachers, some for bus drivers, but there aren't any labor unions. Workers had almost no rights. And this was the way that the Yemen ran its business. And then you had the revolution in Tunis. And before the revolution in Tunis, there was an awakening of intellectuals in Yemen. You have, for the first time 2 years ago, Sana'a University, the University of the Capital, opening up a branch in sociology. And they had a professor in sociology who came and translated works and into Arabic, from English to Arabic. And you had Yemenis doing research about different people. I know there was a group of people in Yemen who come from African descent. And in Yemen, many people in Yemen believe that they were cannibals and ate their dead. This was like an urban myth that people believed it. So when this university opened up the sociology department, they went and did research, and they, you know, came out with reports, and they went to educate the community. They don't do that. And it was that kind of, I'm thinking that really, I think, started this awakening of people in Yemen. And then, of course, the role of social media, Facebook, you know, and Twitter, and being connected with the, you know, Western or Eastern free world and seeing how people had rights and spoke out for their rights. But that was in the Western world. It wasn't in the Arabian Peninsula or the Middle East. Then when Mohammed Abdelaziz in Tunisia set himself on fire, and the sequence of events that happened in Tunis eventually led to the revolution and the overthrowing of one of the most ruthless dictators. And when we look at Tunisia, compared to other, you know, Arab countries, they weren't as bad. The unemployment rate wasn't as bad in Yemen or in Egypt. They had more education. They had more social services. But these people came and protested and overthrew their oppressor. And when Yemenis and Arabs in general saw this, it brought a lot of motivation, and it taught them that they can actually do it. But people were still afraid. No one really went out and protested yet. One of the first people who went out to protest was Twakkul Karman, who later won the Nobel Peace Prize. She went out in front of the University of Sana'a, and she went out with probably 50 people in the beginning, less than 100. And she was jailed. And she wasn't tortured because of the role of the Yemenis there, the way they honor women. And they don't, for the most part, don't torture women or don't allow that kind of, those kind of things to happen. Even in checkpoints in Yemen, if you have a car with some women, with females inside it, they don't check you. Which is kind of weird, because you can just bring your grandma with you and have her hold your AK-47 or whatever. And that's happened. And just kind of mosey along. And if they dare to look at you, you would. It's a huge taboo. So she protested, and the political parties in Yemen, when I say political parties, I mean the branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, they're called the Islah, Reform Party, the Socialist Party, Shtarakia, the Nasrai Party. These parties, they didn't join the revolution at first. You know, they still, and they've had this system of trying to get power from within or stay with the current regime, because they didn't think that Yemen could actually have a revolution. Then when Egypt had its revolution, that was the turning point in Yemen. That was when the political parties joined the revolution and joined Twakkul. And there was a struggle within the people in Yemen, because these political parties for decades had, you know, did not agree with each other and fought each other. And now they're suddenly friends. And they formed a bloc, which they call their part, Jamiat al-Liqa' al-Mushtarik, or the meaning of joint parties. And they were in talks with the government for about a year, before this revolution happened, trying to have some kind of change, but nothing really happened. So they joined the revolution, and then you saw an influx of people protesting in the streets. At that time, the revolution was led by the youth, and they did not want these older people, uncles they call them, hijacking the revolution. Because there was incidents where, because these political parties were a lot more organized than them, had, you know, years of experience and organization, so they would, you know, take over the stages or the microphones. So the youth began to organize themselves, and they formed what they called Al-Mulassaqi Al-Ulya Li-Shibab Al-Taghid, the higher council or coalition for the youth of change. And they were able to organize in all 15 provinces in Yemen. They were able to have committees in every province and spokespeople. They had committees in hygiene committees, women affairs committees, media committees, safety committees. They organized all the protests, made sure they were peaceful, made sure they had the same chance. And they were organizing 15 to 20 million people in Yemen. And this is right after the Egyptian revolution. The issue with the youth of change in Yemen was that they were marginalized by the Yemeni, the president, and then the West. They never were a part of the talks between the Yemeni president and between any of the change councils. The Yemeni president only spoke with the Union of Joint Parties, who were these old political parties in Yemen. And between the youth and these political parties, there was a sort of a unity in the sense they wanted Ali Abdullah Saleh to resign and to step away. But it was the way they wanted it to happen. There was this initiative that came about, the Gulf Initiative, Al-Mubadala Al-Khalijiyya. And in this initiative, there was one thing that the Yemeni youth and Yemenis did not want, and they could not agree with, and that was granting Ali Saleh full immunity, political immunity, for him and his friends and networks of nepotism and business partners. And the Union of Joint Parties, these old political parties, told the Yemeni youth that we just want to expose him to the world because he's not going to cooperate. There's no way he's going to sign it. You know, they would say, نَحْنُ نُرِيدُ أَنْ نُعَرْضِهِ أَمَامَ الْعَالَمِ, that we want to expose him around to the world. You know, he's not going to agree. And for the most part, they were right. It was three times where he said, I'm going to sign this initiative, I'm going to do it, bring the media, let's do this. And each time, he did not do it. Then he did it. He went and he signed it. And from all these dictators, I personally believe that Ali Abdullah Saleh was the smartest one, and the fact that he's the only one that still managed to stay on to power. Even after there was an attempted assassination of him before the signing, and he ran away to Saudi Arabia, his body was burned black, and people thought he was dead for the most part. And even for him to have the audacity to go on TV in that the way he looked, just his face became burned, charcoal burned. His hands, it looked like he had plastic hands on. And for him to go on and still think that he had some kind of authority, you know, Sharia, that was something I couldn't believe. And it's really this mental illness that these Arab dictators had, where they think that they have divine power. There's no way I could, because they could have all left. Gaddafi could have left and still had millions and billions of dollars. They could have just stepped down. But it's a psychological, I think, mental illness. I don't know, Arab dictator syndrome, I don't know what you want to call it. I'm waiting for sociologists to have a term for it. So he signed it. And when he signed it, a lot changed. And I'm going to come back to this. One of the things I want to talk about is the role of Yemenis outside of Yemen, and how that the winds of change came here to America, to England. So I grew up in California for most of my life. Half my life in New York and half of it in California. And Yemenis, for the most part, were not active civically in any way. It's kind of taboo to be involved in politics and go out and like protest and rallies, and they just weren't involved. Of course, for like Palestinian rallies, those kind of things, they would join, but for them to go and out against the president, they never did that. Every masjid, most of the masjids in the where I grew up in San Francisco and Oakland, were run by Yemeni imams, and it was almost an extension of the Yemeni president's party. They always had, you know, their May 22 national holiday, unification. They entered a hotel out, and they had the picture of the president, you know, way in front of everybody. And it was as if he was Yemen, that this guy was Yemen. And they had the same rhetoric, thanking Fahamat al-Ra'is, Ali Abdullah Saleh. As a whole, we think that, you know, the great president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, al-Mushir, the marshal, Ali Abdullah Saleh. And so Yemenis were not outspoken against his, you know, what he was doing, even though they themselves came to this country and worked these hard jobs because of him. Yemenis were involved in immigrant Yemenis were involved in the labor movement in California with Cesar Chavez. You had one Yemeni worker organizer named Naji Zaifullah, who was a prominent member, and he spoke Arabic and Spanish, so he was often translating and bringing the coalition of groups together in the San Joaquin Valley in California. And he was in a picket in a rally. He was killed by the sheriff of a town in Kern County in Southern California, and it was, I believe, in 1970s, and I believe 73, but I'm not sure. But it was definitely 1970s. And and a lot of people don't know about this chapter of Yemeni, of Arab activism. And there haven't been any documentaries done about it. But in San Francisco, a person who you could ask is at San Francisco State University, Professor Rabab Abdul Hadi. She has extensive work and research on this topic, on this person, and his involvement in this. Dr. Abab Abdulhati, San Francisco State University. And so they were involved in agriculture, and then they were also involved in Dearborn, Michigan, and involved in the factory workers at, you know, Ford factory and these kinds of things. And the majority of them ended up working as corner store, grocery store owners, because for them it was easy for them to gain social mobility, to make money, and it didn't require much education or many things. Yemenis, something that differentiates them between them and other Arab immigrants were that they weren't educated. Because northern Yemen was never colonized, and it was the majority of Yemenis, I think, immigrant Yemenis are from northern Yemen, they never understood education or that type of system, or go on to become a doctor. Or the imam who ruled Yemen in the 1960s, he refused to bring any form of Western thinking or Western. Even Ford, the company Ford, wanted to build roads in Yemen. They were going to pay for the building roads. And they, of course, had economic interest, thinking that Yemenis would buy Ford vehicles. The imam refused. He said, I'm not going to let you build roads and then later have you come bring tanks on those same roads. It was similar to the Shogun of Japan. He did not let anyone in or out of Yemen. And the few that he eventually, his name was Imam Yahya, his son, or Imam Ahmed, eventually they allowed some people, a group of people, to go abroad and study in Egypt, and to learn, you know, become military officers and understand Western or modern military, you know, army, and how to have a modern military army. They end up becoming the generals that overthrew him in the beginning. So Yemenis, for the most part, came as from farm workers to Yemen, to America. And that's why a lot of them worked in agriculture when they first got here. So growing up, there wasn't really any civic engagement in Yemen. Yemenis just worked, and any money they made would send them back to Yemen. And they never fully assimilated here. They always had the mentality that I would go back. So my grandfather, he came here in the 60s, worked, built a house, built something in Yemen, and went back. Cousins, uncles, they never lived, they thought themselves as American, you know, as immigrants, not as American citizens. But now it's changed, whereas the majority of them, the situation in Yemen became so bad, they brought their families here. And they lived here. And this has happened in the early to mid-90s, when families started coming here and living in America. And the way our group started, the Yemen Youth of Change in California, was we were invited to a local Yemeni leader in our community's house in California, Northern California. And we got there, and there was about 60, 70 older people that from different parts of the Yemeni community and different political organizations. Some were secularists, some were socialists, some were tribalists, some were Islamists. And they had their usual bickering back and forth. And that usually ends with no one agreeing, and they go home. But this time it was something strange happened. I came with about five of my friends. They asked me to come, college students. And we got there, and in the middle of all this bickering, fighting, you know, we were about to leave. The person who invited us said, wait, hold on a second. Let's hear what the youth have to say. You know, they're the ones who started this revolution, you know, and we used to make fun of them for going on Facebook and all these things, but look what it has done in Tunis and Egypt. And, you know, we were kind of, we didn't expect that to happen, so we just said we need to have a protest, a rally for people to come and support, you know, the revolution. And we formed an ad hoc committee, different people in our community, and we sat together and we thought, how could we support this revolution? What could we do as Yemeni Americans? And the first thing we agreed upon was that we have to have the same goals as the Yemenis in Yemen. We have to represent them, and we have to support them over here in America. So we started contacting our networks of people that in Yemen who were active in the revolution, and we were able to get in contact with a lot of people who were prominent people in the revolution. Tuakul Karman, we had her speak at one of our protests via satellite phone before she won the Nobel Peace Prize. We had Fuad al-Himyari, who is the national spokesperson for the Yemeni youth movement in Yemen. We had... we had people in the Islah Party, the Socialist Party, and we made sure that any language we used was their language. Any chants we used were their chants. So we wanted to have a protest because Yemenis at that point in California, we've never had a rally or protest by Yemenis for Yemenis. And not for nationalistic reasons, we just wanted to say that we can do it and empower our community. So the youth that I work with, we've always worked with other organizations and groups for Syria, for Palestine, and we all had some experience in organizing, but I never did a protest by myself. So we had to learn, how do we organize? How do we get the permits from City Hall? How do we get the vehicles, the sound equipment? Where do we get? We didn't even have flags. We had no Yemeni flags. We had to find out where to get flags from, and delegate tasks. And the first one, it was very difficult. And the other hard part was actually going out to the different communities in California and trying to talk to them about the revolution and have them join our group. So we went out, me and about two other people, and we went to different communities from Sacramento to San Diego, Yemeni communities. We met sometimes in homes. We met in restaurants. We met in masjids. And we just came and said, basically, we want you to support our movement because we were supporting the Yemeni youth in Yemen. And we were able to get a lot of support. And there were all these different types of divisions we had that the Yemeni president had put in place. Sunni and Shia, South and North, Socialist, Islamists, all these different people. And we had to bring them together and tell them we're here together and we have a cause and we want to end this, you know, regime. So we were able to like transcend a lot of these barriers we had, and we were able to bring different people on board with us. And then we had to organize media and outreach and different groups of people and who goes to what masjid and what organization. And our first protest we had 2,000 Yemenis come from California. And for us, that's a huge number for them to come that much. We didn't expect to be that successful in it. And what also was very interesting was like a lot of people in Yemen saw our protests. You know, we filmed them, we sent them clips to different media outlets in Yemen, different opposition satellites aired our footage, and they had us, we wrote our articles, and they published our articles in different publications, Sohail TV and Matter Press and Yemen Times. All of these took our like articles and our work. And so that was the youth of change in Yemen and in California. And what happened was it was very organic. People in Michigan also got together, Yemenis there, and did the same thing we were doing in New York, in Rhode Island, in England, in Switzerland. And through Facebook, we were able to communicate with each other. And we would have one Saturday, we would all have one protest, one chant, one title, one flyer. And we had all these amazing protests. And we tried so desperately to get media to come to our protest. We were able to get local media to come and things like that. But Al Jazeera, we had a difficult time and we didn't know why, what was happening. When the Egyptians have their protests, a few American Egyptians come out, they aired that. And we have thousands of people come, hundreds of people come out, they don't air our protests. And we found out this was a systematic blockade of the media by Al Jazeera. And for them, they didn't want to see a democratic country in Yemen. And then for us, the idea of having this Gulf initiative, there were these, our Gulf neighbors were going to teach us how to have freedom and democracy. These oppressive monarchs, royalists, and were going to teach us how to form a republic. It was absurd and disrespectful, and we were just angry about it. The same time, the human youth in Yemen were marginalized in the talks. They never were able to go and meet the president, opposition, but they still, you know, demanded that everyone he signed it. Millions of Yemenis stepped down. In Yemen itself, the protests that happened in Yemen, because I don't have time to show you, there were millions of people protesting. From all the protests, I haven't seen that many people, you know, in a location except for Tahrir Square in Egypt protesting. 1 million people here, 2 million people here, and 20 million people, or 12 to 15 million people in Yemen protesting. They were extremely organized. Every Friday, well, there was one Friday, the Friday of justice, the Friday of equal opportunity. Every Friday was a specific topic, and they're very organized. But again, Al Jazeera in the Western world did not. It got to the point where even the U.S. government was interested in our work, and they invited 19 Yemeni Americans from different cities, from 10 different states, to go to the White House and the State Department to advise them on Yemen. And I was the one who came from California. And of course, we went there and we talked to them. You know, we want you to support these revolutionaries. They want freedom and democracy. You say that Yemen has about 200, 300 Al-Qaeda members. Well, there's a million people in the streets right now that want democracy. And if you don't support them, you have the potential of radicalizing these people. And at this point, you don't see any American flags being burned in Yemen. You don't see, you know, people chanting these rhetorics of, you know, down with America, down with the West, even though Yemen is being bombed by the first U.S. drone attack happened in Yemen in 2001, and cluster bombs are being used, and civilians are being killed. Over 100 civilians have been killed by these drone attacks in Yemen that still occur now. And instead of giving the Yemeni president $250 million in military aid and having him suppress the population with that, you need to support these people. And he said something, oh, we don't give money, you know, we don't give military aid, we give them resources and whatnot. I said, no, when I was in Yemen in 2009, I saw the Yemeni National Guards with MEM-16s, with Glock handguns, with American-made tear gas canisters. And they did not have these kind of weapons. They had Russian-made weapons previously. So he was following all this to war on terror to oppress his people. And there wasn't any abuse in that meeting. They still, for them, they don't want to see Yemen become free because they take a backseat to Yemeni affairs, to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia dictates Yemen foreign policy because it controls the oil and therefore controls American policy towards Yemen. So America always lets Saudi Arabia do what they want. Even in Yemen, they always supported it. So fast forward now, in Yemen, people became confused because on one hand, they wanted him to step down, but the second hand, they wanted him to be tried. So there were protests for him being tried. Even when he came in, he's right now in New York in the Ritz-Carlton, there was a... He went back, I guess, recently, but last week he was in New York, and our comrades in New York went and protested, and one of them actually threw a shoe at him, a big black Timberland boot, and it didn't hit him, sadly, but the gesture was, I think he got the point. And, you know, there was a sign one of my friends, she had, and it said, the Ritz-Carlton, where ruthless Yemeni dictators go and are served with luxury, in Guantanamo, where innocent Yemeni people are served with torture. And so it's Yemenis, I mean, it's very contradictory the way the American policy is. We support democracy, yet you host a dictator and all these types of things. And they wanted to actually even try him in court here. There was something called the Alien Tort Claims Act, which you can try foreign people in America for war crimes. But because the State Department had agreed for him to come, and technically they said that until the new president's elected, he can't be tried. So there's going to be an effort of Yemenis outside of Yemen in the West trying to freeze his assets and trying to try him in Western courts. But the majority of Yemenis in Yemen, I mean, they just want him to be tried in Yemen by Yemenis. But the majority of Yemenis, and I speak on Yemen Youth of Change here, they have supported the elections in Yemen, even though they feel that they don't like the fact that he's still, you know, immune. But for them, they support it because it allowed some type of change. And it allowed the least amount of bloodshed to happen. Unlike Egypt and Tunisia and these other countries, Yemenis have weapons. There's over 70 million pieces of weapons in Yemen. And if they wanted to, I mean, they chose this to be a civil and nonviolent movement. And I did not believe that would happen. I know tribal members and tribal leaders who just last year would go and fight over the most trivial things, making fun of somebody, disarming them. And they went out there with open chests and would take bullets and take ammunition, and they decided to keep it nonviolent. And for me, that was very empowering, uplifting. I saw them choose that route. So they thought, and they believe that it's the least amount of bloodshed would happen through this way. Third, it gives them certainty that Ali Saleh is out of power for them. And fourth, the main reason why they supported it, and I'm hoping, and I pray that this fourth actually does happen, that it shifts the legality and legislative power from the president to the people. You know, that Sharia tirja ila al-sha'b wa al-shar' al-yamani, that the legality, authority comes and is derived from the Yemeni people and the Yemeni street, not from that old regime. And some of the facts are, you know, some of the things that are still occurring in Yemen is that, you know, the president's son, Hamad Ali Abdullah Saleh, is still in charge of the National Guard. His cousin is still in charge of the Homeland Security. And basically, half of the ministries went to the new council that was elected, you know, but the other half are still in his power. So it's still a long battle for him. You know, he goes in and out of Yemen freely for him to be tried. But, you know, we're hoping that this, they're hoping too, that this new president, who was the vice president of Yemen, and you know, it's the same structure, but we're hoping that this is a real change. And we've always seen some positive signs. Many of the local government agencies, the municipal agencies, the civil agencies, are cleansing their own staff. And you see the directors who yesterday, you know, ruled with iron fist and did whatever they want, are being kicked out of their own ministries. We have picture videos of, you know, in Sana'a and Taiz, all these cities where, you know, the person in charge of a certain agency, he goes there with his, you know, fancy car, and he gets there, and all the employees are outside, and they tell him, "Barab, leave, irhal, you're gone, sit." So there are still positive signs in Yemen. Yemen still has a long way to go. The revolution has changed the mindsets of Yemen. In these squares of change in Yemen, you see so many different arts flourishing. You see people, actors, and you see cartoonists and painters, and things that back were like kind of taboo for someone to be an actor in Yemen. But now all these squares of change, you see different segments of the community, the Houthis, Shia, the Sunnis, the socialists, the Islamists, come together and discuss and talk about their new, you know, government, what they want to do. And that they're not that much different. And the propaganda that the president did was all fake, and that they have so much more in common. And in these squares of changes, you see women playing a vital role in Yemen. Yemen, for the most part, Yemen women had no public visibility, literally and metaphorically speaking, because they were veiled to cover, and they were in public office. You see a Yemeni woman leading a revolution and being respected. You see, in all the cities, Yemeni women actively part of the revolution in Yemen. And this was something new to Yemen. So this revolution really changed a lot in Yemen. Yemeni immigrants here, you know, having women to be more active in our protests and our rallies. And a story I would like to end with is one of the masjids or mosques that I grew up in, that when the revolution first started happening, for me, I had to make a decision of whether I was going to support it, even though a lot of my family were in the government, and I would basically be, you know, blacklisted, and it was a hard decision to make. I chose to support the revolution, and there were very few people that supported it in the beginning here. And I remember that little by little, more and more people joined, and it became the overwhelming majority of people in America, Yemenis, supporting the revolution. You did not have one single pro-government protest or rally, even though the Yemeni government wanted to pay people in New York and in Washington. They were going to pay people to go protest, $500 each. I know people who received the money, and they just didn't show up, you know. And so this masjid, the imam, he was propagating and using this rhetoric that the government has been using, that these are just a bunch of like anarchists and drugs and this and that, and these people who are dying most of the jahiliya, the death of days of ignorance, that these are people who are ignorant, and that they and I remember seeing for the first time, because in during our Friday sermons in Islam, when you sit down and listen to a lecture, is you're as if you're in a moment of prayer, so you're not supposed to speak. And if you speak, you invalidate that prayer. So I saw for the first time in my life people standing up and telling the imam, "Who are you to say that about these people who sacrificed their heart, their lives, these martyrs? Shame on you," and step down. And he had to end the prayer. This happened at least 6 times, you know. And eventually he kicked off he couldn't do Friday Jumu'ah khutbah's lectures anymore. And everyone supported the revolution. My own family, they came to our protest, you know. And It's I'm really excited about the future. I think the political landscape of the Middle East is changing. You know, I hope that this next phase, you know, there's a true change, because the regimes have been changed, but I don't feel that it's a complete change. I don't want it to be where the faces have been changed, but the same people are in power, you know. And we see in Egypt there was change, but still people are trying to fight for that change in different countries. Tunis, I believe, has the most change from these uprisings. And I really hope that that through this process that we see a free Middle East, a free, because this in the end it will benefit everyone in the world. Palestinians will get their rights. People in the West and East will come together. And I think that this type of empire system that we have in the Middle East needs to be eradicated and needs to change. And these people, if you're supporting revolution, democracy, and this type of government, they need to support these revolutions, because I really did not believe just 2 years ago that this would happen. I did not believe that I would see my people here in San Francisco or in Yemen go out and protest like this peacefully. And it really just flipped everything. Yemeni women, from all the Arab women out there, you know, from all the women in the world, an Arab woman becomes Nobel Peace Prize winner. And from all the Arab women, a Yemeni woman becomes a Nobel Peace Prize winner. So I'm going to end on that. There's a lot more I can talk about, but I want to leave time for questions and discussions between you two. And I mean, I hope that I was able to give you some insight into Yemen and to understand it. And again, thank you so much for having me come here.
So, in addition to being able to ask questions to the speaker, we're also hoping that people will ask questions to the audience that we can have more of a general discussion going. So, I encourage people to raise their hand if they have a question. I'll jot down an article of clothing that you're wearing. So, once you've made eye contact with me, you can put your hand down. I ask that people keep their comments to 2 minutes so that we can accommodate everybody. And we'll try it out. I'm thinking we'll get a couple people to make comments or questions, and then we can turn it back over to Mukhtar, and hopefully that way I have more of a discussion. So we'll start with you.
I enjoyed the presentation. We packed a lot of information. I was, however, rather surprised about your take on Tawakkul Khanna. You probably have seen her tour in Washington, D.C. I don't think she carried herself well in any way that would make the Yemeni people proud in any way. I mean, either she comes to Washington, D.C. To be used in a show by Hillary Clinton and her staff. And then, of all places in the world, she thanks Hillary Clinton for her support, not only of the Yemeni revolution, but also of the Arab Spring. That in itself, to me, was a watershed. Of course, I mean, the Nobel Committee always do what they know what they do when they pick Arabs. The second point about that is, I don't know if you've seen her remarks during the election yesterday. She expressed her pride that the new president is from the South, totally ignoring the role he played in 1994 as the enforcer on behalf of the Ali Abdullah Saleh.
To answer the first part of your question, her main objective when she came here, and when she was here, we were in contact with her. We were hoping to have her come to San Francisco, and we were organizing for her to come to City Hall with the mayor and have an event for her there. And her whole point of coming to the West was to advocate for the Yemeni cause and the Yemeni revolution. And she was a lot more, I would say, radical in a good way before the elections, recent elections, where she was demanding that he must be tried, that we're not going to sign this Gulf Cooperation Initiative, boycott on the elections, and these types of things before. And in regards to her meeting Hillary Clinton and going to the State Department and all that, I really think she was trying to get the most media coverage because, you know, if you hear a Nobel Peace Prize speech, which is a great speech, if anybody have time, it's online, and read the transcribe, the in the translation of it, she might have not mentioned Palestine, you know, and but back to your question about why should that? I think she really wanted to get the most media coverage, and from all the people, she was successful in a sense that she did that when she went. And for other uprisings too, when she went to the Munich security event 3 weeks ago, she mentioned the Syrian uprising and asked Arab and different countries to close their Syrian embassies. And for me, when I saw that she was supporting the elections and the words she says, I was disheartened about it. You know, all my friends here, you know, we understood that these elections are good, but we really felt ashamed that people can even call this an election because it's only one candidate. And even me, you know, I speak on behalf of the Yemeni Youth Council and Yemeni people here, their position is that they support the elections for the reasons I mentioned. Personally, me, I took a more of a boycott election kind of approach because I think that to have change, you have to have real change, and it has to be a complete eradication of any oppressive system. And that means it has to completely go away, not through shuffling. And for her statements about the vice president, if you look at what he did in the past in the South and his support of the revolution, he's a person whose hands are filled with blood. And he is the one of the people that needs to be tried. So, like I said, if their authority does not come from the people, you know, I'm hoping that this is a real change and that it will allow that real change to occur. But for me, I will not be happy, and the Yemeni people won't be happy until we see all these people, the new president now, the president, all of them tried by Yemenis in Yemen. And I think that she really just wanted to have the most visibility for the Yemeni cause, you know, because she really went down from her rhetoric of saying that we have to boycott and he has to be tried. And now actually, you know, you picture her with her thumb up with the ink that she voted and saying she's happy he voted. There was actually a split between the opposition. So, we need these type of questions, these critical questions, because, you know, nothing is perfect and nothing is clear. And really, every day in Yemen, like, it's very interesting because things change so fast. I have people who I was with on board a month and a half ago. Now they won't even talk to me because of what happened, the kind of thing. So it's always changing. Today, there's a rumor. I saw a picture on Facebook. I haven't verified it. That the first act of office that the new president did was he raised the military rank of Ali Saleh from a mushir, which is a marshal, to a muhib. I'm not sure the translation of a muhib is the next. It's a higher position. I'm not sure if that's correct, but if that is correct, then it's really not a good sign. Anybody else have any more questions or?
Over the decades ahead, what do you see as the best case scenario, and then what do you see as the worst case scenario? You know, which direction, and what do you think is the most likely scenario? Also,
The ideal scenario for me would be, and this is what it would be, that the authority of the constitution, that Yemen becomes a country where the government, the civilian, become the overseers of the people in power, you know, and that is a big change. That's what we want. That's where the power comes from: people, democracy, rule of people.
And we hope for that here as well.
Everywhere in the world, you know. Of course, there are a lot of powers, foreign and internal powers, in Yemen that do not want that to happen, and you know. And the worst case scenario is that we have Ali Saleh, the new face, and we just keep seeing these new faces happen. And I hope that that does not occur, because It there won't be real change, and it will be the same system. So I hope that through time we see positive steps. And the first thing that I think that's going to happen is having him tried, the president, former president, tried, and that's really going to be something. Just like, I mean, Egyptians, when they saw Gamal Abdel Nasser, when they saw Hosni Mubarak in that cage, that was a huge thing for them, you know. And the Yemenis, we want to see Ali Saleh in a cage. It's a very good question. The revolution should be a revolution in all aspects: social, economic, political. And the people in the South, and I am not going to speak on behalf of them, but they have been oppressed for a long time, and they have very, you know, valid points. And they say that, you know, we were in socialism, we're Marxism, we're all the resources, everything was owned by the government and land, and then at least we benefited somewhat through that. And now when these guys came over, they took everything by force, and we saw nothing out of it. So we want we either want you to give us back our land, have a redistribution of the land and the wealth, or let us rule ourselves and secede for ourselves. And I mean, I really don't want to speak on behalf of them, but in terms of economics, people should be able to, you know, rule themselves and decide how they want to be ruled. And they should not be forced into a unification. You know, they need to understand that this is what they want to do. And one of the main focuses of the whole revolution was, you know, and why we were able to be successful in uniting people was that we wanted to bring up their issues. And for the most part, the majority of people in the South, they want to be unified. From the ones I've talked to and spoken to, and they want to be one Yemen. There is a segment of people that want to secede, but the majority of them want to stay in one Yemen if they are equal economically, politically, socially, if they receive what the people in the North receive, if they receive. And the thing is, I always tell them, we're also, you know, we're also oppressed in the North. You know, there's so many different stories of people being, their land's been taken away by the Yemeni government, the president's house. My own family, my cousin, he had a brand new car and it was stolen by someone from the president's family. And if my family wasn't from a tribe, we were able to have our tribe come, and then, and eventually they apologized. And it was in Yemen, it's kind of interesting the way tribal society works out. The way this particular thing happened was when they saw we had a tribe and we came from my tribe is probably 5,000 people, and we go to a bigger sub-tribe, which is about 20,000, 30,000 people, and they go to like a bigger tribe, which is, and then goes to like the tribal confederation. There was an article, and then they asked a child member, "Are you afraid of Al-Qaeda? It's like, they're a couple of hundred. I have 30,000 fighters in my tribe. I'm not afraid of them. So the president, their family came, and our family came. Our tribe leader was there. They recited a poem, apologizing. We recited a poem, accepting their... They gave us our car and a new car and a bunch of cows. We had lunch, and that was it. So for us, we could do that. But people in the South, because they don't have tribes, they can't do that. And they don't have any way of getting their just due. So the whole point is to have a system, a civilian system, and the tribal leaders have agreed to this. We want to have a civilian system because they're tired of fighting themselves. They're tired of fighting over land and different armed killings, these kind of things. A civilian system where everybody's equal in the law. Doesn't matter what color you are, what social ranking you are, what tribe you're from. And that's the whole point of revolution, a civil, hukm madani, they say, a civil, like a law ruling. Hopefully that answers your question.
Start, like, for example, there was labor militancy in Egypt that I think was the thing that probably made Mubarak give up, because he probably thought that, you know, the economy was going to be brought down. So I wonder if you could just comment on that.
So the concept of like workers unions in Yemen, and speaking of the north is where I'm from, there really isn't that many unions at all. There's not teachers union, but they have no power in Yemen. Or any in governance, and because of that, workers have no rights. The only type of union kind of work I've seen happen in Yemen that was successful was one time the cleaners, the people who cleaned up the streets, they protested because they lowered their minimum wage, and they just didn't clean anything for like a week, and ended up getting their demands. But in terms of people going in that type of system, I haven't seen that happen in Yemen. In the South, I assume because they were socialists, Marxists, they have more of these type of things. But even then, I haven't seen like any huge groups like that. I have seen in the protests a lot of radical left, you know, ideas, pictures of Che Guevara, you know, people protesting with those kind of pictures, these kind of things that people in Yemen didn't know who he was, or you know what that was, in northern Yemen, actually, not in southern Yemen. But I mean, I hope that they have this type of system where they have unions, because that's the only way you can guarantee workers' rights, I think. In the South, again, I'm not sure. I mean, I assume that they have more unions because they had a socialist system type of government. But again, I'm not sure the type of repression that the president have had on the South, because I think he, at one point, he even banned unions there. Hopefully that answered your question.
I like your talk. I really appreciate the optimism you have about the future. However, just thinking about some of the factors that you very clearly articulated in the history, in particular the sharp division between North and South, the history of political violence, the tribal alliances, all this sort of thing. And then on top of that, a sort of thing that I hear about Yemen a lot is that it's a very highly armed country, that they have more arms per person than, most any other state. So I'm curious how that, how they got to become like a place with so many arms. How did those arms come in to begin with? But given that, given all those factors, it seems likely that a violent, conflict would ensue if some major shakeup were to take place. What do you think gives you optimism? Is it the youth that are taking part in it, and how could that be avoided? It just seems like when you have all those things together, that violence, you know, you put a gun in a room, you know, like the, it's like a literary technique or reference. If a gun enters a book, then someone's going to get shot, you know, and if there's all these weapons, like, it just seems like there might be something like that.
It's a very important question, and I ask myself that question a lot. You know, how is a country with so much weapons and so much history of violence and political violence, how are they able to sustain a peaceful, nonviolent movement for so long? At first I thought that was not going to happen. I thought that eventually they would take up arms and Yemen would be similar to Somalia, just anarchy and bloodshed. And there was one Friday, and this was a turning point in Yemen where a lot of the tribal leaders, a lot of the army defected. It was called Jum'at al-Karama, the Friday of Karama of Dignity, in which 55 protesters were killed by snipers in Sana'a. And that was the first huge, like, political violence in Yemen by the regime and that on the people. And I thought that next day all hell would break loose and people would be out with their AK-47s and their machine guns. So the first part of the question, how it became that way, was I think that the Yemenis themselves are, again, they're into their tribes, and they've always had tribal conflicts, and it's always been a way of life, tribal way of life, you know. And you have to have your weapon, your arm. Even now, when you go to weddings, people have their AK-47s and their guns. I was kind of like, even Yemenis themselves, they walk around with a dagger called a jembia, and this dagger, the hilt is made of rhinoceros horn. And if you go to any zoo in the world, wherever you go, and you go see the rhinoceroses, the rhinos, you see a picture of the Yemeni dagger, and it'll say that it led to almost the extinction of rhinos, you know. So it's a sad part of our history. But the dagger is rooted in the Arab tradition of having your weapon with you. Even now, even when I go to Yemen, I have my dagger, I wear my dagger. And this is something of the northern people, tribes wear. So it's a part of their culture. You have the tribal society where you go back to your tribal leader and there's no hesitation to go into a war with another tribe if the tribal leader said so. And it's very structured that way. And then you had all these different wars that happened in Yemen between the north and the south, the Imam, the British, the colonizers. And then in the 70s and 80s, there was a socialist movement in the northern parts of Yemen. There was armed rebellion that was armed by the south in the central parts of northern parts of Yemen, and where my family was from, where they would go and they formed militias and they tried to have an organic social uprising militarily, and they would go around killing the tribal leaders because they wanted to eradicate that system of that structure. My father's uncle, my grandfather, was a tribal leader in my family, and he was 39 years old, and in 1986 he was assassinated, and they blew his car up with the RPG. And then these types of things happen. So there's always been like violence in Yemen in some way or another. And the reason why I think this is why it's been able to stay peaceful was because after that Friday of Dignity, Jum'at al-Karama, when 55 people were killed, the youth were able to talk about nonviolence as the only way, talk about how it's the safest way to save Yemeni blood, have the backing of tribal leaders, and it really, really revolutionized the way Yemenis thought of everything. Because again, they would go into trivial wars over the smallest insignificant things. So I really think that it was just, they just decided to do it, and because they were able to hold back when someone shot them and killed them, that it doesn't matter what happened afterwards, they were able to stay and keep it a non-violent, you know, movement. Because if they wanted to, they could have radicalized and made it into a violent movement. And their goal was always two goals. The first one was to have it non-violent, like in Tunis. That's what they wanted to have. If not, before he signed the Gulf Initiative, it was very close to having the Yemeni youth and the government political parties, they were going to decree the use of violence and armed resistance. And they began training people. Women were starting to be trained how to use AK-47s and these type of things. So it was very close, but that decision wasn't made. And right before that decision was made, and I think that's what pressured him to sign in the first place, they stopped it. I still think that's on the table, that Yemenis, that if this change has not happened the way they want to, they will resort to violence. But again, this is why they signed this. These people, why Tuakul Kerman, why she supported the revolution, the elections? Because she really, they wanted to save them the most amount of Yemeni blood as possible.
Thank you very much. And thanks for showing the pictures. I worked in Yemen. And I loved it, so this was nostalgic. And I have a few things to say. It was very interesting. I mean, it's a great presentation. obviously joined the research and so on, but what's interesting to me is the different perspective. Definitely there's a generational factor. And second, I like what you're doing in California, and everything, almost everything I learned about Yemen was firsthand. Working there and talking to people and understanding the history, and it's a very violent and bloody history. However, a few things that I would say is, as you said, the problems of Yemen are known. High fertility, very high illiteracy, very high levels of corruption, especially now. And the north and south, they are almost two separate entities. The control of the north over the south is very sad, of course, because it deprived the north of the opportunity to learn from the south how to do management, proper civic management of life. On the contrary, they just took over and violated everything. One of the things I like about Yemen and the Yemenis, and especially the Yemenis of the north, is their free spirit. So there's freedom and lack of fear in Yemenis, and this is what I found to be compelling, amazing. I mean, Yemenis have no fear. I can say that with confidence. So, and I think what happened now is the politics and probably very much the lack of opportunities for Yemenis to organize because of the poverty. There's so much poverty, people can barely put food on the table. The other thing is the corruption, of course, which gets in the ways, and the tribalism and the political tribalism and so on. The role of the unions, there is to have naqabat, you know, there is the general federation, but of course, again, it's fraught with corruption and nepotism and so on. I want to talk about the role of women. Women in Yemen are very courageous, and there's women in high positions. And there's no problem with women being in public life, in the public sphere. I mean, the women work in many places. Of course, there's a huge disparity between the urban major cities and the rural areas. It's very much a traditional system, yet, traditional society, but women are active. And some of the very well-known women have made it to very high positions, and like Amat Lamy.
She was the Minister of Information.
In New York. Raufa Hassan started the first center for women in Yemen, and unfortunately it was closed down because she was so vocal, and she did great work. And then Tawakkul, and I can see how a young woman can be influenced to do lip service, although I respect what she did. But I think the fact that she's young and she could be co-opted in presenting a certain picture about Yemen. There's no mention of Yemen without mentioning Qat, and unfortunately, again, that's a major problem in Yemen, and I'm not making any judgment on the use of it, except that it's taking over the water resources of Yemen, and that it's not being fought by the leadership, which is very unfortunate, because, you know, the money can go towards agriculture, and what you were talking about, you know, the coffee as a cash crop and so on. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that.
So much love.
No, thank you so much. Thank you so much for that. I would say that the topic of Qat, it's a whole topic by itself, subject by itself. And basically, it's a leaf in Yemen that is a socially acceptable and politically legal drug. And Yemenis, basically, instead of working, what they do is after noon prayers, they go eat lunch, and they stay in these long, they call them diwans, long living rooms, and they sit down, they chew this drug, and it's a stimulant, like a mild stimulant. It has some methamphetamine effects in it, and it kills a lot of the Yemeni economy, because 80% of Yemen's water resources goes to this drug, and it's used by 90% of people in the north. The southern people, they don't use it too much, but the northern people, they use it a lot every day. So if people don't work, there's no shift. They go from noon till nighttime, they chew. There's some positive things that it's a social drug where people get together and talk about issues they go through and different stuff. And some people say they'll do other drugs. But in general, millions of work hours are wasted a day because of this drug. And they could invest it in other types of agriculture. And the government should subsidize and should be government-driven. The South, I didn't mention this, but the South did have a lot of positive things when it was separated. Women were a lot more free in the South. They were less restricted in the way they dressed and the way they presented themselves. I think women were more in government. They had more positions in the north. There are a couple here and there, you know, Nadia Sakaf, Yemen Times director, but there isn't a lot, you know. So I think that the government should have learned a lot from the south and used that, but it ended up becoming a tribal government. Even Al Jazeera, they did a documentary, they called it Yemen Jumhuriyat Al Qabail, Yemen, the Republic of Tribes. So, like, it's this whole, like, system, cultural, traditional system. Not too much Islamic, but more cultural. And it needs to be changed. And unions definitely need to play a bigger role in that. It's a long process, and I think Yemeni people are up for it. There are a lot of Yemenis in the West that have educated and have a lot of, like, one of the people on our board, his name is Dr. Hilal Ashwal. He was a medical director, or a professor at Harvard. He right now is in charge of a neurology institute in Switzerland, and he's the advisor for the health minister in Qatar. These types of people should be taken to Yemen and given positions of, you know, of importance for their role. So I hope that, like, Yemenis still have that spirit of, like, outspokenism. And again, you don't see too many prisoners, like political prisoners in Yemen compared to other countries because of their, this is the culture, the way it is. You know, you have people who they're very free. I compare them a lot to, like, people in the south here. Very similar. The way they have guns, the way they're with their families and their moral rights. But, you know, I hope that they become, they go and progress and they become more knowledgeable of some Western concepts and maybe have a Yemen where the north and south both benefit from each other. I hope the south doesn't secede. I hope that it becomes unified. And I think that, I appreciate your comment. Thank you so much.
Okay, we have time for one more comment. I have you on my list. But first, I just want to let everyone know that the plenary discussion is starting at 5:30. It should be really great, so I hope you all can make it to that. It's going to be in the room right next door. Also, I would really encourage you to check out our Haymarket Books Room. There are a lot of different fantastic titles related to the talks today. So, last question.
Yeah, we keep speaking of women as almost like a split personality, and I wonder, in your opinion, if it would be better if it split again, like a Velvet Revolution, like in Czechoslovakia.
Again, I think that I would like to see a unified Yemen. Historically, it's one country. Culturally, there's so many things that tie them together. And I would like to see that happen. But I think that it's the people in the south, they should decide for themselves. From the people I've spoken to, the majority of them want to be unified as long as it's a true unification. I think that division is not always, it doesn't really help too much. I mean, I think that if you keep dividing people because they disagree, eventually you would have too many splits. And the same thing in Iraq right now, what they call, you know, progress because of the surge, it's just really just a distribution of different people, Kurds in north, Sunnis and Shias. And if you keep dividing people based on these things, you're never going to form a real, like, unity. People need to know how to agree, disagree, and form government. And this is something that's going to be interesting in the whole Middle East, the Muslim Brotherhood with secularists, with different groups. How are they going to unify themselves? And there are a lot of positive signs. You know, Dr. Yusuf Al-Qadhawi, he was really, like, a big scholar in Muslim scholar, and has a lot of he has a lot of impact, especially on the Muslim Brotherhood. And he gave a fatwa, which really is a good sign. He said that universal freedom of human rights goes above having Islamic Sharia. And hopefully they can take this idea and have a government where we would have more rights for Christians in Arab countries, more rights for Kurds, Sunni Shias, and there won't be the split. Because it isn't about this different splits. In Yemen, you have Salafi Wahhabis, you have Shia Zaydi. 35% of Yemenis are Zaydi Shias. You have Sunnis, secularists, and you don't see wars between each other. You just don't. I mean, I've seen, like, when you go to the mosque, you'll have a Wahhabi Saudi-trained imam with his red, you know, scarf, checkered scarf, praying, leading prayer. You have the imam, the Zaydi Shia Adhan. You know, there's a difference in the way they give their call to prayer. And then you have a Sufi, mystical person from Hadhramaut give a talk afterwards, and there isn't any problem. And I think that Yemenis, they understand this concept of being Yemeni, and they accept all segments of the society. And I really think that they're not going to secede. I hope they don't. And it's up to the South to decide for their point. But thank you for that question. It's a very important question.
Thank you.